Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, May 19th. Study says soaring income could help overcome inflation, but not all Midlanders earn enough to let them stay in area. The story was written by Mellie McEwen. From 2010 to 2020, Midland residents saw their per capita income jump 37% or $32,600, according to a study from LLC.org. That put per capita income at $119,000 in 2020, up from $87,000 in 2010. It also compares to the national average increase in per capita income of 25% or $12,000 over that same 10-year period. Authors of the report say the study of 350 metropolitan areas yielded mixed results, with some residents' incomes outpacing inflation, but other residents seeing their income struggling to keep pace with inflation. Midland's inflation-adjusted income growth has been above average, the study authors told the Reporter-Telegram by email. Quote, all else being equal, this better positions its residents to deal with the current high levels of inflation, end quote. However, they continued, quote, it's still very unclear how the situation will develop in the coming months and years, especially in commodity-driven economies like Midland, which inherently have more volatility, end quote. Midland has the highest per capita income among all cities, noted Midlander Mickey Cargill of Cargill Investment Management. Among small metros, he said, Midland's per capita income is $30,700 higher than the second-place city. Its growth rate of 37% over the last decade places Midland 18th among all metropolitan areas and 11th among small metros, Cargill said. Quote, our area's high per capita income is due to the good, high-paying jobs in the energy industry, he told a Reporter-Telegram by email. The cost of living is always higher in Midland, and inflation runs hotter here during the boom cycles. The higher costs are directly related to the higher incomes available in the community, end quote. Recent high inflation and supply chain shortages affect all communities and disproportionately affect those not directly benefiting from the energy boom, Cargill continued. He said the high per capita income in Midland not only makes it the best area to withstand inflation, but it also creates more tax revenues to support infrastructure and support of local charitable missions. However, Cargill cautioned, quote, it is difficult for those not directly benefiting from the energy boom to stay in the area due to the high cost of living, end quote. LLC.org study found that the U.S. economy is now a full year into a historic run of inflation, with year-over-year price increases in the Consumer Price Index peaking at 8.5% in March. Despite widespread concerns about inflation, the study said not every household experiences rising prices in the same way. For example, homeowners who bought before the pandemic have been spared from spiking prices for housing costs, while remote workers have been less susceptible to rising costs for vehicles and gasoline. And amid a tight labor market and the Great Resignation, many workers have seen their wage gains outpace the rate of inflation, but for those who haven't, rising prices have effectively given them a pay cut. Changes in cost of living have also affected workers differently according to geography, the study found. More than two-thirds of states saw cost of living decrease relative to the national average in the decade before the pandemic. In contrast, coastal states like Washington, Oregon, and Massachusetts led the nation in cost of living increases over the same span. According to the study, the state whose workers might be best off in recent years is Utah, which saw the nation's fastest growth in real per capita income from 2010 to 2020 at 43.1%, and had the seventh lowest change in cost of living over that span. At both the state and metro level, other locations have struggled with the opposite problem, slower increases in income alongside faster increases in cost of living. States where incomes have increased most slowly over the last decade include Alaska, Connecticut, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. National Weather Service says streak of 100s now at 5 days. Midland already has had more 100-degree days than in all of 2021. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Wednesday's high temperature didn't reach the 105 degrees like the National Weather Service expected. That's about the only break Midlanders have received during the run of hot temperatures this week that has baked Midland. The high temperature at Midland International Airport did reach 101 degrees, which wasn't record-breaking, but did give Midland its seventh day of 100-degree weather in May. That total is already more 100-degree days than during all of 2021. The 101-degree day was also the fifth straight in Midland and was 12 degrees warmer than the average for May 18th, 89 degrees. The National Weather Service on Wednesday afternoon was calling for a high temperature of 103 on Thursday and a high temperature of 98 on Friday. Quote, "Very hot conditions will continue for Thursday, with most places experiencing highs in the triple digits," the National Weather Service Midland office reported on its website Wednesday. Quote, "Some daily record high temperatures are likely to be tied or broken. Make sure to limit time outdoors, especially during the afternoon hours, and drink plenty of water," end quote. Temperature relief will come in the form of cooler temperatures, even 25-plus degrees cooler this weekend. The National Weather Service forecast for the weekend showed high temperatures of 89 on Saturday and 75 on Sunday. The next chance of showers is expected Sunday night and Monday, according to the National Weather Service. USGS says 11 quakes since May 11th. Latest for Midland area was a 2.1 magnitude quake Wednesday morning. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. There have been 11 earthquakes around the region since May 11th, according to information from the U.S. Geological Survey. The information collected on the website earthquaketrack.com shows quakes near Stanton, Big Spring, and Gardendale. Those quakes included one at 4:39 a.m. Wednesday, a magnitude 2.1 quake 11.8 miles northwest of Stanton. The website also showed three other quakes northwest of Stanton, three quakes near Big Spring, and four quakes near Gardendale or north of Odessa since May 11th. The magnitude of the quakes has ranged from 1.9 to 2.7, according to EarthquakeTrack.com. The website shows that quakes around Midland and farther west around the Loving County city of Mentone are still happening, even if at a lesser rate than in January. Around Midland, there have been 10 quakes in the last 7 days, 22 quakes in the last 30 days, and 229 quakes in the previous 365 days, according to information posted Wednesday. In January, the website showed 249 quakes in the previous 365 days. The area around Mentone remains one of the most active regions of earthquakes in the nation. EarthquakeTrack.com reported 37 quakes in the past 7 days, 165 in the previous 30 days, and 2,147 in the previous 365 days. In January, the website showed 2,448 quakes in the past 365 days. By contrast, EarthquakeTrack.com showed Wednesday that there had been 365 quakes in the last 365 days around Los Angeles, 341 around San Francisco, and 336 around Hennessy, Oklahoma. EarthquakeTrack.com reported 9 earthquakes in far west Texas with magnitudes of 3.0 or higher in the last 2 weeks. A quake with a magnitude of 2.5 to 5.4 is often felt, but only causes minor damage, according to Upsize, an educational site for seismologists. The Reporter Telegram has previously reported that Permian Basin producers and the Railroad Commission have worked together to put together a response plan to address seismic activity in seismicity response areas around Stanton, Gardendale, and northern Culberson and Reeves counties. Here is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter Telegram on Thursday, May 19th. Wife of disabled veteran fights a battle of her own. Dear Abby, my husband is retired from the military and living with a mental illness caused by a traumatic brain injury. As a result, he's disabled. We have 4 children. Over the years, he has developed an extreme sense of financial entitlement. Although I'm responsible for our finances, I cannot control his spending. His compulsions include luxury coffee, fast food, and medical marijuana, which cost hundreds every month, yet he complains when money is tight. Last week he lashed out, saying, "I hate that everything has to go through you," as if I am the reason we don't have more spending money. Money is scarce, and our children are going without things they need. I'm always fighting for his respect, decency, and self-control. I feel frustrated, exhausted, and lost. Advice, please. Signed, Angered in Arkansas. Dear Angered, I wish I could wave a magic wand and make your very real problem disappear. Because I can't, you are going to have to step up yet again and impress upon your husband that while you are sad that he regards what you are doing for your family as controlling, your children's needs must come before his own. By that I mean he should treat luxury coffee as a luxury and buy it no more than X times a week, ditto for fast food and his medical marijuana. If he needs more pharmaceutical support for his stress, he should address it to his doctor at the VA, I assume. Make clear that you cannot carry more of the load and that you are not the cause of the financial stress. Circumstances are to blame for that, and he cannot continue to kick his golden goose, or he will kill it. Dear Abby, my mother, who lives with me, insists on keeping her window open several inches year-round. While I don't mind so much in the winter because I know she tends to run hot, we clash in the summer because I need the windows and doors closed so I can run the air conditioning to optimal efficiency. She thinks keeping her window open is cooling her bedroom off and doesn't understand what the problem is if she keeps her door to the rest of the house shut. This issue has caused major arguments because it's making my AC unit work harder than it needs to, not to mention I have allergies and my doctor has told me to keep the air on all summer long. This is a ranch-style home, and the temperature is kept at 70 degrees. I don't want to fight with her, but I feel disrespected since this is my house and she blatantly disregards my requests. Am I overreacting, or does she need to be respectful of my home? Signed, Temperature Rising in Ohio. Dear TRIO, you aren't overreacting. Let's get down to basics. Whose house is it? It is yours. When you lived in your mother's home, she made the rules, and you had to abide by them. If keeping her bedroom windows ajar is making your air conditioner work harder, then it's likely adding to your electric bill, which is disrespectful, inconsiderate, and bad manners. If she can't adjust, she should contribute toward the extra cost of air conditioning. Chamber ED says marketing dollars well spent. The story was written by Kim Smith. Tom Mansky, the new director of economic development for the Odessa Chamber of Commerce, said he's pleased after his recent deep dive into the Odessa Development Corporation. Mansky recently looked at how much the ODC has spent on incentives since 1997 to get companies to come here, employ workers, and spend capital on new and existing facilities. He also looked at the ODC's contract with the chamber and how much it spent on marketing efforts during the same time period. He then came up with a dollar-for-dollar return on investment. He believes it may be the first time such an analysis has been done, and he determined the return on investment for incentives paid was $14.21 for every dollar spent, and the return was $69.01 for every dollar spent on the chamber contract. When it comes to marketing, Mansky said the return on investment was just under $113 for every dollar spent. In looking specifically at incentives, Mansky said Odessa is doing exceptionally well. Quote, some other people in the industry will tell you they'd like to see at least $4 to $5 return on their investment, and if we're getting $14, then I would consider that in the very good realm, if not excellent, end quote. Those numbers are about to skyrocket too, Mansky said. Once Nacero's $7 billion gasoline plant is created, Mansky said the ODC's return on investment when it comes to incentives will increase to $375 per dollar spent. All told, the ODC spent just over $79 million from 1997 to 2021, and the return on investment was $10.61, which Mansky called a really good number. Mansky also discovered that, thanks to the ODC's efforts, 2,221 new jobs were created and 1,123 jobs were retained since 1997, resulting in nearly $143 million in annual payroll, which helps support the area's restaurants, retail stores, etc., he said. Quote, we're probably the roughest critics on ourselves. I would call it satisfactory, Mansky said, of the jobs retained. Quote, I'd like to retain more than that, and it could be more than that. We're just trying to report it the best that we can, what we can find on paper. We certainly want to keep moving that number up. We've got some good projects going. I'd like to see, with that number right there, 1,123, I'd love to see us at 2,000, maybe by 2026, 2027 at the latest, end quote. During last month's ODC meeting, board member David Boutin thanked Mansky for his work. Quote, I think it's important that we do evaluate our success, our performance. Trying to determine a return on investment for our expenses is difficult because you don't know exactly where they're spending their money, how much sales tax is generated, Boutin said. He and fellow board members Chris Cole and Chris Crow urged Mansky to dig even deeper by looking at other communities, including San Angelo, Lubbock, Longview, and Amarillo. On Friday, Mansky said he's been reaching out to other development corporations. Quote, "Trying to get some of that information out of other organizations is not always an easy thing, getting them to stop and take my phone calls. But I've tried to reach out to a few to get some of that before our next meeting," Mansky said. And looking at the contracts signed over the years, Mansky told the board he discovered mixed results in terms of promises made and promises kept. Quote, "There were some projects that didn't meet the requirements, and they didn't get paid, and we had to get money back. But there were also a number of projects that, on their last report, were well above what they had committed to, and they still were paid for what they committed to, but they provided more jobs and more payroll than what they had put into their application," Mansky said. Mansky said he and his staff have begun to go back to companies whose contractual obligations to the ODC have long ago ended to see how they are doing and to see if they can be nurtured and grown even more. The Chamber's economic development team is working on other projects as well. Quote, "I examine our processes all the time. We just got a new software program that Lindsay here in our department, she's going back from the beginning of time as far as our projects, and she's putting those things into this program, and it's going to give us better, more useful information," Mansky said. "I think if nothing else, we're going to track things better than we've done before, and I'm not saying people didn't track things good before my arrival. We just got better technology at our fingertips that we're willing to incorporate than we had 10 years ago. We've gone out and found some of that, and we're making use of it," end quote. The ODC's next scheduled meeting is 2 p.m. Wednesday.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness. Fiber is on menu for healthy life. One of the most important nutritional recommendations for overall health is taking an adequate amount of daily dietary fiber. You might be surprised to know that 97% of Americans do not get the minimum daily fiber requirements in their diet. We are a, quote, fiber deficient, end quote, population. The average American adult eats 10 to 15 grams of fiber, which is less than half the daily requirement. If we could get Americans to just eat the minimum recommended daily intake of fiber-containing foods, we could save our country $80 billion. And that's just from the effects on constipation alone. While 97% of us eat an excess of protein every day and still remain worried about whether we are getting enough protein when it comes to our gut health, where we get our protein from matters. Fiber-rich plant protein promotes the growth of healthy gut bacteria. In contrast, fiber-deficient animal protein promotes the development of inflammatory gut bacteria. These unhealthy bacteria produce toxins like amine sulfide secondary bile salts and TMAO. These toxins are associated with food sensitivity, colitis, and many gastrointestinal cancers. Increased levels of TMAO from heavy consumption of animal protein, egg yolk, and dairy products can increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, type 2 diabetes, congestive heart failure, and atrial fibrillation. A plant-based diet promotes gut bacteria that do not know how to make TMAO, protecting us from these chronic diseases. The path to overall health and wellness is through our gut. We have 39 trillion microorganisms in our colon, and many argue that we are only 10% human and 90% bacteria. The human microbiome is composed of bacteria, archaea, viruses, and eukaryotic microbes that reside in and on our bodies. These organisms have a tremendous potential impact on our bodies, both health and disease. They protect us against pathogens, help our immune system, and control our overall health through these basic functions. A growing scientific consensus helps us understand the critical role the human microbiome plays in various diseases. When we lose the harmony and balance of these gut bacteria, we are prone to a variety of common diseases, including obesity, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, fatty liver, autoimmune diseases, hyperlipidemia, hypothyroidism, PCOS, infertility, depression, anxiety, and many other diseases, including a variety of cancers. Our diet and lifestyle choices decide what type of bacteria we will have in our gut, healthy or unhealthy. In addition to antibiotics and medications, a diet consisting of sugars, highly refined carbohydrates, salt, preservatives, artificial sweeteners, unhealthy fats, and animal protein disrupts the gut microbiome. Did you know that there is no dietary fiber in meat, chicken, fish, milk, or eggs? How do we promote healthy gut bacteria? The answer is quite simple: fiber. It is not what you take in the form of a pill, powder, or packaged foods, but what is abundantly present in all edible plants on this planet. One of the most prevalent nutrient deficiencies in the American diet is not getting enough fiber. Most soluble fiber is prebiotic, which means it feeds healthy gut bacteria. These healthy gut bacteria release short-chain fatty acids to heal the colon and prevent the growth of unhealthy bacteria and thereby suppress inflammation. Every day we make this simple choice between health and disease, which comes down to what we put on our plate. Every bite is a step toward a healthy life. It is time to make fiber our new friend and ask ourselves, where am I going to get my fiber from? At the Lifestyle Medicine Center, our mission is to empower patients to make simple lifestyle changes that can profoundly affect their health and well-being. If you would like to learn more about improving your health and reversing some of your chronic health problems, call 432-221-LIFE, 5433. Prevent heat exhaustion with these tips for fun and sun this summer. Texans have seen record-breaking heat this May, with highs ranging from the mid-80s to near 100. In less than 2 weeks, MedStar reported 23 heat-related cases of patients requiring treatment in the Fort Worth area and 3 calls about kids in hot cars for the beginning of the month. As the summer season approaches, here are some tips for keeping safe out in the heat. Heat exhaustion versus heat stroke. Heat exhaustion is when the body loses large amounts of water and salt through excessive sweating, particularly through hard physical labor or exercise. Symptoms include muscle cramps, paleness, sweating, nausea, and vomiting. According to MedStar, children and the elderly are especially susceptible. If you or someone you know experiences heat exhaustion, the National Weather Service advises moving to a cooler area, loosening clothing, and drinking cool water. If symptoms don't improve, seek medical attention. A heat stroke is when the body suffers from long, intense exposure to heat and loses its ability to cool itself. This is a life-threatening problem. According to MedStar, common signs of heat stroke include confusion, vomiting, alteration in sweating, hot and flushed skin, rapid heart rate, decreased sweating, shortness of breath, decreased urination, increased body temperature, or even convulsions. Heat stroke is a medical emergency. If you or someone you know starts experiencing heat stroke symptoms, immediately call 911. Ways to prevent heat exhaustion, heat stroke. Here are some tips from MedStar on how to prevent heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Hydrate with plenty of water, especially during sports activities. Ventilate with air conditioning or fans and open windows. Cover up with light-colored, loose-fitting clothing and a hat to block out the sun. If your body becomes too hot, MedStar officials said to remove hats to prevent more heat from getting trapped close to the body. Limit strenuous activities and take time to cool off. Check on elderly family members and friends to ensure they're staying protected against the heat. Children and pets should never be left unattended in hot cars. MedStar advises securing vehicles to prevent children getting trapped inside and set reminders to remember the vulnerable passengers. If a child or pet is unattended in a hot car, alert authorities. U.S. allows more baby formula imports to fight shortage. Under fire from parents and politicians, President Joe Biden's administration announced steps Monday to ease a nationwide shortage of baby formula, including reopening the largest domestic manufacturing plant and increasing imports from overseas. The Food and Drug Administration said it was streamlining its review process to make it easier for foreign manufacturers to begin shipping more formula into the U.S. Quote, the FDA expects that the measures and steps it's taking with infant formula manufacturers and others will mean more and more supply is on the way or on store shelves moving forward, end quote. FDA Commissioner Robert Califf told reporters. Califf said the U.S. will prioritize companies that can provide the largest shipments and quickly show documentation that their formulas are safe and compatible with U.S. nutrition standards. The policy is structured as a temporary measure lasting 6 months. The imports announcement came shortly after regulators said they'd reached a deal to allow Abbott Nutrition to restart its Sturgis, Michigan-based plant, which has been closed since February because of contamination issues. The company must overhaul its safety protocols and procedures before resuming production. Neither step will have an immediate effect on tight supplies that have left many parents searching for formula online or in food banks. After getting the FDA's okay, Abbott said it will take 8 to 10 weeks before new products begin arriving in stores. The company didn't set a timeline to restart manufacturing. Getting imports into the U.S. supply chain will also take several weeks, according to administration officials. Products from Australia, New Zealand, and the U.K. are expected to meet the standards needed for importation. But regulators said national industry data shows most U.S. stores, on average, still have 80% of their formula inventory in stock. They suggested some of the empty shelves seen in recent days may be due to panic buying by parents. Monday's announcement was previewed last week by the White House, which has been leaning on the FDA and formula makers to quickly find ways to alleviate the shortage. Outrage over the issue has quickly snowballed and handed Republicans a fresh talking point to use against President Biden ahead of November elections. The shortage stems from a February recall by Abbott that exacerbated ongoing supply chain disruptions among formula makers, leaving fewer options on store shelves across much of the country. The shortage has led retailers like CVS and Walgreens to limit how many containers customers can purchase per visit. Abbott's voluntary recall was triggered by four illnesses reported in babies who had consumed powdered formula from its plant. All four infants were hospitalized with a rare type of bacterial infection, and two died. Experts predict 3.4 million cases of skin cancer in 22. Roughly 3.4 million U.S. residents will be diagnosed with skin cancer in 2022, according to estimates compiled by the American Cancer Society and the American Society of Clinical Oncologists. The vast majority, 3.3 million, will have basal cell or squamous cell carcinoma, while the others, 99,780 people, will have melanoma, the less common but more dangerous type of skin cancer. Cancer experts predict that 7,650 residents will die of melanoma this year. Overall, about 20% of Americans develop skin cancer at some point in their lifetime. Men more often than women, but women generally at a younger age than men. Anyone can develop skin cancer regardless of skin color. Skin cancer ranks as the most common cancer in the United States, but it also is considered the most preventable. Most of the time, skin cancer develops because of overexposure to ultraviolet UV rays, either from the sun or from an artificial source such as a sun lamp or tanning bed. UV rays damage skin cells, causing abnormal cells to form, rapidly divide, and spread. Treatment varies by a skin cancer's type and stage, but common methods include surgery to shave or cut away the cancerous tissue or freezing, known as cryosurgery, to destroy the tissue. Preventing the development of skin cancer starts by protecting the skin from UV rays. According to the American Academy of Dermatology, that means avoiding indoor tanning and, when outdoors, seeking shade whenever possible, wearing protective clothing, sunglasses, and a wide-brimmed hat, and applying a broad-spectrum water-resistant sunscreen with a sun protection factor, SPF, of 30 or higher to all skin not covered by clothing. All exposure to UV rays, not just sunburn and blistering, but tanning too, can lead to skin cancer.
Hello, this is Cindy, continuing to read from the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Thursday. Death notice. Catherine S. Shelby, 53, of Midland, passed away May 17th. Cremation services have been arranged by the family. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com.
Good morning, this is Kim. I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Thursday, May 19th, 2022, commissioners discuss ARPA funds. During a two-hour special meeting Wednesday morning, multiple volunteer fire departments, Medical Center Health System, and the Ector County Utility District asked for American Rescue Plan Act funds. The court currently has to disperse $16 million from the ARPA, while it's scheduled to get another $16 million in ARPA money from the U.S. Treasury Department this summer. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes started the agenda, detailing no action would be taken on Wednesday afternoon and that the meeting was solely to hear the needs of the agencies. The total amount the five agencies asked for came out to a little more than $26 million. Hayes said many of the agencies that she expected to come out did on Wednesday, but she also explained there were some that didn't. She said agencies are welcome to submit to the courts, whether it's through a phone call or in writing. Hayes said the court plans on distributing the funds during the next 30 days. There are a significant number of needs throughout the community that would benefit our community as a whole, Hayes said. An Austin consultancy firm, GrantWorks, was hired by the court to review the various requests. GrantWorks ARPA project manager Andrea Souffle opened the agenda item by saying there are five prohibited activities: no offsetting of reduction of new tax revenue, no deposits into petition funds, no debt service or replenishing financial services, no satisfaction of settlements or judgments, and no projects that conflict with ARPA. Souffle added that every project that is approved by the court will need a letter of justification because it has to tie back into COVID. The volunteer fire departments that asked for funds during Wednesday's meeting were the West Odessa Volunteer Fire Department, South Ector County Volunteer Fire Department, and the Goldsmith Volunteer Fire Department. WOVFD Chief Richard Pease requested a little more than $5.6 million that included equipment and a new fire station. Pease said the fire station alone would be about $4.5 million and a tanker truck would be $500,000 and two brush trucks would be $330,000. You don't know how much sleep I've lost knowing that I'll have to spit this number out, Pease said during the meeting about requesting about $4.5 million for a new station. Goldsmith Volunteer Fire Department asked for funds that would help them purchase a tanker truck, a small brush truck, and fire rescue equipment, while the South Ector County Volunteer Fire Department asked for funds that would help them pay for grants, bunker gear rack, and PPE cleaner. ECUD asked for about $13.6 million that would be used to fund 13 projects. The projects are also listed in priority. Tommy Irvin, ECUD president, gave the Odessa American the same packet of information that was given to the court. The top priority is the Buddy West Elementary water line, which details the project would be an 8-inch water line in front of Buddy West Elementary School. The justification for the project is currently ECUD's fire hydrant in front of the school is connected to a 4-inch water line, which doesn't have the required fire flow capacity. The project would be $443,600. Irvin said he's hopeful that 100% of the funds that he requested funds for would be approved. Hopefully they will fund it all, but they won't, Irvin said after the meeting. They won't fund 100% of that. MCHS President and CEO Russell Tippin asked the court for $7 million for staffing and supplies. Tippin said the requested funds would go toward contract labor, which are contract nurses and contract respiratory therapists. At our highest time, we had over 100,000 contract nurses and contract respiratory therapists in the hospital, and now that number is down to 61, Tippin said during the meeting. Commissioners also heard that Ector County Elections Administrator Lisa Sertucci about the canvas vote totals for the election held on May 7th. Sir Tucci said there were 7,843 votes cast out of 82,527 registered voters. That's a turnout of 9.5%. The court also approved the tax abatement for GCC Permian LLC in Ector County, Precinct 4. Hay said one of the stipulations would be approved for the 10-year tax abatement that the GCC Permian LLC needed to pay their taxes in full. Commissioners also approved notifying the Boy Scouts of America that they will not renew the organization's lease on the Henderson Drug Building located at 204 North Grant Avenue. The lease ends in September, and Hay said the Boy Scouts of America are using that building primarily as storage. The court is willing to help the Boy Scouts of America find a new building. Inspiring young musicians, Cassette in the Basin returns to Odessa. Throughout this week, orchestra students around Odessa have received lessons and tips from members of the New York-based Cassette String Quartet, which is part of Cassette in the Basin. Cassette in the Basin is a music educational program that brings the Cassette String Quartet to West Texas biannually to inspire and work intensively with students from elementary to college and help expand their horizons as well as develop people through music. Cassette in the Basin was founded by Odessa native Jennifer Leschnauer. She is currently a violinist for the string quartet. Cassette in the Basin is a music education program that's in West Texas that brings my quartet from New York to work intensively every day inside the schools with student orchestra programs, Leschnauer said. We not only coach them, but also talk about how music can shape your life and the skills required to play, specifically leadership and communication skills that are applicable to anything a student will do in life. This week, the Cassette String Quartet has been at Odessa High in the mornings and Permian in the afternoons, in addition to a few performances at UTPB, Ray Great House Recital Hall at the Wagner Noel. Our aim is to inspire them and be examples and mentors to what is possible if you work hard and focus your energy and find something that you're passionate about, Leschnauer said. Cassette in the Basin got started in 2005. In addition to Leschnauer, the Cassette String Quartet consists of Muniko Otani on violin, Rosemary Nellis on viola, and Gwen Krosnick on cello. The Cassette String Quartet has performed all over. The quartet has been invited to share its program at Texas A&M University and the Hot Springs Music Festival in Arkansas. Leschnauer said she started up Cassette in the Basin to give back to the community that helped shape her as a musician. I'm from Odessa, Leschnauer said. I'm a graduate of Permian High. When I finished my master's degree, I had the opportunity to work in the Midland Odessa Symphony as a member of the string quartet. With that experience, I then was asked to join the Cassette String Quartet in New York. After a good bit of time, I was asked to give back to the community, and I felt that bringing my colleagues to share their expertise and be inspirational to the next generation of students would be meaningful to donate to West Texas. Violinist and Cassette in the Basin alumnus Dominique Valenzuela, who is also a native Odessan, returned to town this week and joined the group's events and master classes. Valenzuela is getting ready to study at the Juilliard School in New York this fall to get his master's in violin performance. This week has been the first in-person visit for Cassette in the Basin since before the pandemic in 2020. Sparks calls for power grid upgrade. Senator-elect puts energy industry's problems on Biden's doorstep. Texas Senator-elect Kevin Sparks won't take office until next January in Austin, but he hopes to be appointed to the Senate's Natural Resources and Economic Development Committee and address his concerns about bolstering the state's electrical power grid and its oil and natural gas industry. Elected without a runoff over three March 1st Republican primary opponents and having no opposition in the November 8th general election, the Midlander says there are not enough natural gas-powered electrical generation plants in the state, and a recent announcement by the Public Utilities Commission was worrisome that Texans should set their air conditioners on 78 degrees to avoid blackouts. I expect at a bare minimum that I will get asked to serve on the Energy Committee because nobody in the Senate has the scope and breadth of experience that I have in the energy industry, said Sparks, president of the Discovery Operating Independent Oil and Gas Company and an employee of the family business since graduating with a business degree from the University of Texas, 1986. The Texas power grid is very much at risk, and we should be concerned that we have sufficient energy to power it, he said. We haven't made the fundamental structural changes that we need to make in order to make it secure. Referring to the winter storm Uri spawned outages of February last year, Sparks said one thing that was in the legislation last year after the big freeze was that those backup generators had to have access to backup generation so that they could come up with the electricity when they are called on. That provision was stripped out of the bill and the governor put it on the PUC, but I don't believe the PUC has made that happen up to this point. We get 30% of our electricity from wind and solar, and if we have a real hot day or a real cold day, we might not have sufficient power generation. Ready to Succeed retiring 31st District Senator Kel Seliger of Amarillo, Sparks said May 11th that the situation is getting more urgent because 1,500 people are moving to Texas each day and we are not adding reliable power to our grid. He said the Permian Basin has the advantage of being a relatively low-cost oil and gas-producing region, but it and other energy-producing areas are being bedeviled by the Biden administration's open hostility to the industry in deference to the president's political indebtedness to the Green New Deal environmentalists. The current administration is really doing everything they can to thwart hydrocarbon production, and they can do an awful lot from D.C., Sparks said. Obama had a lot of stuff teed up to implement, but Trump got elected and put a lot of that back in. Then Biden came along and reversed it. Now they're making everything as cumbersome and expensive as they can because their motive is to put us out of business. Along with high prices for oil and gas, he said, the cost of pipe has doubled in the past year, and the cost of fracture treating and running rigs has greatly increased. In addition to that, Sparks said, a lot of the larger companies are capitally constrained. The oil and gas business globally is lifting people out of poverty, and we don't have the technology today to replace hydrocarbons and maintain our standard of living. He said another priority when he takes office will be to help upgrade foster care. We need to continue working on community-based foster care, Grant said. Our foster care system in Texas right now is broken. Quick hits, early voting. Ector County's early voting schedule for the general joint primary runoff election. The following locations will be open during early voting only through Friday. Ector County Courthouse Annex, 1010 East 8th Street, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Branch locations from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Callis Turner Community Building, 2230 Sycamore Drive, MCM Elegante Hawaiian Ballroom, 5200 East University Boulevard. The Globe Theater at Odessa College, 2308 Shakespeare Road, and Salinas Community Building, 600 West Clements Street. Election Day is May 24th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. For more information, call 432-498-4030 or visit tinyurl.com/2P8E2PF5. Memorial Day Veterans Luncheon. First Baptist Church, 709 North Lee Avenue, has scheduled the Memorial Day Veterans Luncheon from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. today in the Commons area. All veterans are welcomed. Each veteran is welcome to bring one guest. To register or for more information, text VETERAN to 40778 or visit tinyurl.com/57HTZ3NM. Art Talk, the Ellen Noel Art Museum, 4909 East University Boulevard, has scheduled Art Talk ENAM Permanent Collection at 6:30 p.m. today. Admission is free. For more information, visit noelartmuseum.org. Westside Diner. Odessa High School choirs are combining with Bowie and Crockett Middle School choirs to present Westside Diner, a dinner and a show at 7 p.m. today at the Ector County Coliseum, Barn G, 4201 North Andrews Highway. The choirs will perform Disney tunes and some of their best soloists. Hamburger and hot dogs will be served with chips, dessert, and drinks. There will also be a silent auction to benefit the choirs. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students and children. Visit tinyurl.com/2P886MP5. Worship Concert. Singing Men of West Texas Worship Concert will take place at 7 p.m. today at First Baptist Church, 2104 West Louisiana Avenue, Midland. Admission is free. Visit tinyurl.com/MWPCAACB. Stop the Bleed Day. Medical Center Health System and Odessa Mayor Javier Hoven will recognize Thursday as National Stop the Bleed Day during a special proclamation on Thursday morning. The brief ceremony will take place at 8 a.m. in the ECHD boardroom on the MCH campus. In addition to the proclamation, the MCH Trauma Service Department will be holding two free Stop the Bleed classes in the ECHD boardroom to educate the community. These classes are open to anyone and feature a formal presentation followed by hands-on experience, which will show you three quick ways to control serious bleeding. Class times are 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. To sign up, email Sierra Watts at sperkns@echd.org. A third of U.S. should be considering masks, officials say. COVID-19 cases are increasing in the United States and could get even worse over the coming months, federal health officials warned Wednesday in urging areas hardest hit to consider reissuing calls for indoor masking. Increasing numbers of COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations are putting more of the country under guidelines issued by the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention that calls for masking and other infection precautions. Right now, about a third of the U.S. population lives in areas that are considered at higher risk, mostly in the Northeast and Midwest. Those are areas that people should already be considering wearing masks indoors. But Americans elsewhere should also take notice, officials said. Prior increases in infections, in different waves of infections, have demonstrated that this travels across the country, said Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, said in a White House briefing with reporters. For an increasing number of areas, we urge local leaders to encourage use of prevention strategies like masks in public indoor settings and increasing access to testing and treatments, she said. However, officials were cautious about making concrete predictions, saying how much worse the pandemic gets will depend on several factors, including to what degree previous infections will protect against new variants. Last week, White House COVID-19 coordinator Dr. Ashish Yua warned in an interview with the Associated Press, the U.S. will be increasingly vulnerable to the coronavirus this fall and winter if Congress doesn't swiftly approve new funding for more vaccines and treatments. Xia warned that without additional funding from Congress for the virus would cause unnecessary loss of life in the fall and winter when the U.S. runs out of treatments. He added the U.S. was already falling behind other nations in securing supplies for the next generation of COVID-19 vaccines and said that the domestic manufacturing base of at-home tests is already drying up as demand drops off. Xia said domestic test manufacturers have started shuttering lines and laying off workers, and in the coming weeks will begin to sell off equipment and prepare to exit the business of providing tests entirely unless the U.S. government has money to purchase more tests, like the hundreds of millions it has sent out for free to requesting households this year. That would leave the U.S. reliant on other countries for testing supplies, risking shortages during a surge, Xia warned. About 8.5 million households placed orders for the latest tranche of 8 free tests since ordering opened on Monday, Xia added. The pandemic is now 2.5 years old, and the U.S. has seen, depending how you count them, 5 waves of COVID-19 during that time, with the later surges driven by mutated versions of the coronavirus. A 5th wave occurred mainly in December and January, caused by the Omicron variant. The Omicron variant spread much more easily than other versions. Some experts are worried the country now is seeing signs of a 6th wave driven by an Omicron subvariant. On Wednesday, Walensky noted a steady increase in COVID 19 cases in the past 5 weeks, including a 26% increase nationally in the last week. Hospitalizations are also rising, up 19% in the past week, though they remain much lower than during the Omicron wave, she said. In late February, as that wave was ebbing, the CDC released a new set of measures for communities where COVID-19 was easing its grip, with less of a focus on positive test results and more on what's happening at hospitals. Walensky said more than 32% of the country currently live in an area with medium or high COVID-19 community levels, including more than 9% in the highest level, where CDC recommends that masks and other mitigation efforts be used. In the last week, an additional 8% of Americans were living in a county in medium or high COVID-19 community levels. Officials said they are concerned that waning immunity and relaxed mitigation measures across the country may contribute to a continued rise in infections and illnesses across the country. They encouraged people, particularly older adults, to get boosters. Some health experts say the government should be taking clearer and bolder steps. Widow files civil lawsuit against Odessa bars. The widow of a 30-year-old Odessa man who was killed in an alcohol-related crash last fall has filed a civil lawsuit against 3 bars, alleging they continued to serve him alcohol despite knowing he was intoxicated. According to the lawsuit filed in the 161st Ector County District Court Tuesday on October 23, 2020, Rogiello Sushil Jr. became visibly intoxicated while at the Black Gold Sports Bar, the Agave Bar, and Stein's Ultra Bar, all located at 4555 East University Boulevard, and yet employees kept serving him. Sushil left the bar in his Ford F-250 and lost control of the truck on North Loop 338 near mile marker 280, the lawsuit stated. The truck went off the road, rotated counterclockwise, went into a skid, crossed both lanes of traffic, ran through a barbed wire fence, and rolled multiple times, throwing Sushil from the truck. According to the lawsuit, Sushil's blood alcohol level was 0.161, more than double the legal limit. Natalie Sushil's attorney, Jason Webster, Heidi Vickner, and Russell Sirafi of Houston allege each of the bar served an obviously intoxicated person, failed to control the amount of alcohol they gave him, and allowed him to operate a vehicle. They are seeking unspecified damages on her behalf for past and future mental anguish, pain and suffering, pre-death fright and pain, funeral and burial expenses, and her husband's lost future wages. In addition, they are seeking compensation for the loss of her husband's companionship, support, and consortium. Messages left at the bars were not immediately returned. According to his obituary, R.J. Suchiel Jr. was survived by his wife, parents, grandmother, two sisters, and three nephews and a niece.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.